Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is the second of our speakers in the series for this summer here at CSIS, what we call the Japan Policy Fellows. My name is Michael Green. I'm the Japan chair here at CSIS and also an associate professor at Georgetown. And we started this program last year to get rising stars in the academy, in the social sciences, people on track to get tenure or higher promotion in universities across the United States who are doing interesting work and important work and research on Japan and on Asia. And we wanted to grab them as their, you know, rocket soars up, grab them briefly, and let them share some of their insights with the policy community in Washington. One of the things that's happened, I grew up in this town, and one of the things that's happened over the years, I've found as both a Washingtonian and a policy guy who's also got one foot in academia, is that as Washington becomes more partisan and more focused on short-term political news, academia is becoming more theoretical and less interested in immediate challenges. And in some ways, these two communities, which have been so important to each other, are drifting apart. So in a way, Nixon, Cheney, and all of us at CSIS feel like nakodo, like matchmakers, to reintroduce the rising stars in academia to the rising stars in the policy world and make sure that their research being conducted is helpful and useful and comes into the debate in Washington, and also to give a good network. And so we've had three speakers now, two last year and now two this summer. We'll have more to come. And it's been very interesting. We've had good turnouts. Thank you for coming, because I think people in Washington working on policy are interested in carefully crafted social science research on Japan and on Asia that will help to inform the policy debate. Our speaker today is Philip Lipsky. Lipsky, do you pronounce the C?
It's Lipsky.
It's Lipsky, who is at Stanford University, where he's an assistant professor. He's got a joint appointment in the political science department and in the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Affairs, the policy center there. He's a student of Harvard University, PhD, under Susan, I think, right? Yep. Susan Farr, among others. And before Harvard, received his MA at Stanford and has done something of a sort of a return of the prodigal son, I suppose, back on the Harvard faculty. He writes and teaches about political economy and international organizations, U.S.-Japan relations. We talked about the topic, and we went around with several different titles. We ended up, obviously, with Asian regional cooperation and global reform after the financial crisis. We're trying to find a title that would capture two elements of what Philip's working on. One is how Asia and Asian regionalism and Asian regional architecture has been affected, or the debate's been changed or accelerated by the current global financial crisis. And then the other is how global architecture has been affected, particularly with stronger voices from Asia. So, you know, we came up with about 15 titles to try to capture both of those, and then we finally ended up with this one, which nicely, I think, captures the full spectrum of what Philip's going to talk about. So we'll hear his presentation. You have some PowerPoint. That's good. You've already got one piece of Washington figured out. and then we'll open it up for free discussion in the audience. So over to you, Philip. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Mike for that very kind introduction, and Nixon Cheney, of course, for being such a great host. You know, when I told some of my colleagues over at Stanford that I was coming out to D.C. around this time of the year, they told me that it was going to be hot and muggy and everybody's going to be on vacation. But it's an amazing turnout, so I hope this isn't your idea of a vacation. thank you for being here today. The topic I'd like to discuss today is really some of the long-term consequences of increasing economic instability, this recent economic crisis being one element of that, but also what can be done over the short and medium term to respond to some of the new challenges. So to provide a brief overview of the presentation, I'd like to basically argue that we're entering an era that is fundamentally different from the past 20, 30 years, one that will feature quite a lot of economic instability and volatility, similar to the 1930s, though probably not as bad. And there's a new challenge in terms of managing economic crisis, which is essentially the Japanese-style financial crisis, the type of crisis that the United States is undergoing right now. And it's a type of crisis that, because it's relatively new, we don't have very good international organizational responses or really means of cooperation. It's being done in a very ad hoc manner. And finally, I'd like to talk about the institutional architecture and the rise of Asia. Essentially, how can we address the existing mismatch between how international organizations are structured and the underlying change in the international system, essentially the rise of Asia in relative economic terms. So just briefly going over the financial crisis in historic perspective, generally, if you look at the economic literature on these issues, economic integration tends to produce economic volatility. And there are many reasons for this. But essentially, if you have a world economy that's not very well integrated, one country might have a crisis, but it might tend to be isolated. But as the world economy integrates, it's more likely that a crisis will spread very quickly, essentially contagion. You saw this in the Asian financial crisis, and you see it today. Problems become greater in complexity and scope. The private sector becomes bigger in relation to the public sector, and there are more transmission mechanisms, capital flows, trade, direct investment, etc. This is a graph from Reinhart and Rogoff. The red line is essentially the degree of capital mobility in the international system, and the blue line is the incidence of banking crises. So what you generally observe over time is that as capital becomes more mobile, so people are able to invest in different countries across the globe, there are more financial crises and banking crises in the world. And this was very true in the early 20th century, in the era preceding the Great Depression. You had a series of crises, and ultimately around the 1930s, the crises became so big that it overwhelmed the existing system, which was based on the gold standard. Just one illustration of how coordinated these crises have become. This is stock markets, world stock markets during Japan's bubble in the 1980s and early 90s. You know, it looks like Japan is really an outlier, right? Japan at the peak here was 60% of world stock market capitalization, but the bubble really sort of went up and burst, but pretty much besides Japan, other countries were not affected. In comparison, this is the current crisis. You really see that even though the red line, the U.S., is generally considered to be the epicenter, there's nothing remarkable about how the U.S. stock market has behaved. And housing tells a similar story. In the run-up to the recent crisis, housing markets worldwide, with a few exceptions like Germany and Japan, experienced a bubble. So the United States was really not the worst bubble in terms of residential real estate. Ireland, U.K., Spain were worse. Australia, France, Italy were almost nearly as bad. So we're seeing much more coordination of economic both boom and bust cycles, and this presents a host of challenges for the international system. In addition, what we have increasingly is the Japanese-style financial crisis that tends to affect developed countries rather than developing countries, right? Until the Asian financial crisis, we had a series of developing country crises in Latin America, moving on into East Asia, Russia, etc. But the Japanese-style crisis affects the most important economies, America, in Europe, in Japan, and they have similar features. They're generally preceded by asset price bubbles in equities and housing, but economists have still to figure out exactly how we should respond to these types of crises. So the response tends to be quite ad hoc. Bernanke wrote a paper on the Japanese bubble and how the United States should respond if this type of thing should happen. And a lot of monetary policy in the United States has really been guided by lessons from Japan. But the Japanese argument has always been, if you do what Bernanke's doing today, you're going to get runaway inflation. So the verdict is really still out on whether or not Bernanke's policy is the correct one. You know, it currently looks like that might have been the right idea, but there's still very little consensus. And most importantly, I think, there really aren't good international mechanisms to manage this type of crisis. You know, but the consequences can be quite dire. This is Japan's real GDP growth since the 1950s, and you can see after the bubble bursts, growth has been really anemic, about 1% annualized growth, whereas potential is probably in the range of 2 to 3%. So really you've had a major slowdown in economic growth and real economic consequences. However, the policy response poses a variety of challenges. Responding to economic crises of this nature, especially in the political sense, is very difficult. Bailouts, as we're seeing in the United States today, are very unpopular. It appears that the government is essentially rewarding imprudence, giving money to people who already have money and who acted selfishly or took too much risk. Fiscal policy raises concerns about rising deficits. And monetary policy, as we're seeing today, gives concerns about inflation. In Japan, there was a lot of discussion about low interest rates hurting people who save their money and put it in banks. And if crises tend to lengthen, there's a risk of response fatigue, right? You have this in the 1930s in the United States and also 1997 in Japan, where the crisis is going on, and at some point people say, well, isn't enough enough? Why don't we start rebuilding our national accounts? And so fiscal policy retrenchment occurs, taxes are raised, and the economy ends up back in recession. So, you know, this is an interesting dilemma, and here's one illustration of the dilemma, which is the economic performance of different countries during the Great Depression. And what you see is essentially the autocracies did quite well, whereas the democratic states did not do well. And one of the arguments you can make about this is that autocracies are less constrained by popular backlash against the type of responses that are necessary in this type of crisis. And you can see some element of this going on in China today, because, you know, at least so far, it looks like China's response has been more rapid and more effective than the response in Western democracies, Japan, et cetera. So what can be done? What you'd imagine to be sort of the default solutions, you know, sort of economic textbook solutions to this type of crisis are quite difficult. One argument that's often made in the economic literature is, well, can we do some kind of preemptive action against bubbles, essentially deflate these bubbles before they get going? But it's always difficult to take away the punch bowl when the party's going on, right? So when Alan Greenspan made his irrational exuberance speech in the 1990s, he was widely criticized. So it's not clear that that's an option. IMF intervention is not really possible. The IMF has a lot of leverage over developing countries who need IMF funding in order to get through a crisis. But for developed countries like Japan and the United States, Europe, the IMF has very minimal leverage, so there isn't an international mechanism to really push countries to adopt the correct policies. Exchange rate intervention, for example, trying to allow countries to inflate their way out of the crisis by depreciating their currencies, all kinds of trade-related problems. Capital controls are very practically difficult to enforce. So because of all these factors, it's likely that we'll end up in a very difficult period in terms of world economics. We'll likely see a series of economic crises. And the question is probably going to be, how do we manage these things after they occur? One potential solution on the political side, I think there's a lot that can be done on the economic side as well, regulating banks and hedge funds, et cetera. But I think one thing that people have focused less on is the political aspect of this, which is essentially a lot of these policy responses are politically unpopular, as I mentioned earlier. So it might be helpful to move some of the responsibility for these policy responses to the international side, right? This is what's done in trade through international trade agreements and the WTO, for example. you know, if there's a solution, formal policy coordination mechanism that sets targets for fiscal policy. This is done on an ad hoc basis right now, but if it's more formalized and it's turned into an international commitment, essentially it would be easier for politicians to say, well, we're spending a lot, but this is because we have international obligations to do so, and it's for the good of the international economy. And it would be less politically sensitive and difficult. You can imagine a mechanism, for example, to pool funds for financial sector bailouts. Oftentimes, financial sector bailouts are profitable for the governments that conduct them, but when the crisis is going on and the bailouts are being, the funds are being invested, there's a lot of criticism because it looks like taxpayer money is being wasted. So if the funds could be essentially borrowed from other countries on a temporary basis, perhaps, at least on the surface, it would look less popular or it would look less damaging for the politicians who need to implement these policies. And, of course, you need greater policy coordination among central banks, especially in regards to quantitative easing, which is a novel policy and essentially an experimental phase. Lessons need to be shared. Clearer guidelines need to be set up, especially because, as you've seen with the U.S. Federal Reserve right now, when the central bank gets into purchasing private sector assets, it raises all kinds of issues about potential political meddling in monetary policy. So moving on to the other major challenge for the world economy in coming years, I think the role of East Asia is really going to become a critical issue. The world economy is increasingly shifting towards being centered around East Asia and the Pacific. Economic power transitions tend to create economic instability. So even setting aside all the things that I've already said, it's generally the case that when economic power shifts from one region or one country to another, it creates a lot of volatility. You saw this when British hegemony gave way to the United States taking on a greater economic role in the world. However, there's a very serious mismatch between the Eurocentric nature of the existing architecture of international organizations and the economic reality that is gradually coming into being. So I think, at least on a temporary basis, what we should be aiming for is to create some type of system that can work if we have an economic crisis episode centered around East Asia. The current system is very ill-suited to the challenge. So I think we need to work on at least some kind of temporary system to make sure that the damage can be limited and also work on the long-term solutions. So I'll talk about both of those things. So this is just quickly a cartographic representation of world GDP. The first one is 1900, right? So this is essentially the country's size is representative of the size of their economy, and this is the peak of European colonialism. And you see that really Europe dominates economically the rest of the world. This is 1990, it's about 20 years ago. You see that the world is much more like three regions, with Asia dominated to a significant degree by Japan. Now, finally, this is conventional estimates of what the world will look like maybe in 10 years or so. You can add plus or minus 5 years. You really see the shift from the three regions of the world to Asia becoming increasingly dominant. The world economy is increasingly going to become synonymous with the Asian economy. So in light of this change, we need to set up mechanisms that will allow Asia to be smoothly integrated into the world economic system, but also managed effectively. And a major problem currently is what academics call path dependence in the IMF. Essentially, representation in the IMF does not reflect economic reality. And in my own work, I've done analysis of IMF voting shares over time, and it's very clear that there are very large distortions. Right? So the IMF quota formula is set up so that countries should roughly have voting shares that are in line with their weight in the world economy. But what you find is essentially there's a lot of historical dependency. If you have a big share of the voting shares 20 years ago, you're likely to have a big share today. And what that means is there's a fairly significant overrepresentation of European members and underrepresentation of Asia, because Asia has just grown a lot more than Europe has over the past 20, 30 years. This is sort of a stylized example of what I'm talking about. If you look at the Axis versus Allied powers of World War II, you find that the Allied powers have consistently been overrepresented in the IMF versus the Axis powers. And this is despite the passing of about 60 years since the end of World War II. So what you find is in institutions, generally speaking, history has a very powerful effect. Right? There's always renegotiations taking place. There's small incremental changes happening, but they tend to lag behind the underlying reality. And for better or for worse, sometimes it's good to have that stability, but sometimes that stability can also cause problems. So how about on the outcome side? How about IMF lending? So I've also looked at IMF lending, and what I found is countries, developing countries with strong economic ties as measured by things like trade, FDI, and bank lending to the U.S. and Europe. So these tend to be countries like Mexico, Brazil, Russia. They have a tendency to receive larger IMF loans with looser conditions. And as a consequence, these countries tend to hold smaller levels of foreign exchange reserves. This is a moral hazard problem, right? If you can depend on the IMF to bail you out, maybe you don't need as much foreign exchange reserves. And as a result, they've been susceptible, compared to other countries, to currency crises over the past, 30 years or so. In comparison, Japan has gotten the raw end of the deal, in essence. Countries that have close economic relations with Japan, it's the opposite, right? They tend to get smaller loans from the IMF and end up holding more foreign currency reserves. And essentially, reserves are private insurance against economic crises, right? So if you can't depend on the IMF to bail you out, you want to hold a lot of reserves because that way you're less likely to get involved in a crisis. So just to take an example, Mexico in 1994, we would expect a much nicer reaction of the IMF because Mexico has very close ties with the U.S. versus Thailand in 1997. So you can think of some consequences of these distortions of IMF lending and representation. One is you might get uneven moral hazard in the global economy, that essentially countries that have close ties with the United States or Europe or private sector actors that have close ties might end up taking riskier bets because they feel like the IMF is more likely to bail them out on better terms. There might be a disadvantage to private sector actors that are based in Asia. And if you talk to policymakers in Asia, there is a sense, at least, that during the Asian financial crisis, the IMF did not respond favorably to Asian interests. Eisuke Sakakibara, who was the vice minister of finance at the time, very clearly states that his perspective on what should have been done in Indonesia, for example, was ignored by the IMF and the U.S. Treasury. And you could argue that as a result of that, you've had excessive reserve accumulation in Asia and a lot of the global imbalances that you observe unwinding today. So what's been going on in terms of regional cooperation in East Asia? Two major initiatives. ASEAN Plus 3 has been working on quite a lot, really as a consequence of the Asian financial crisis. You've had a much greater impetus towards cooperation in East Asia over the past decade or so. The Chiang Mai Initiative, which I'll talk about quite a bit here, and the Bond Market Initiative. The Bond Market Initiative is really about developing domestic bond markets. There's some questions as to whether it's going to be effective or not. But the Chiang Mai Initiative, I think, deserves some discussion. It was recently multilateralized, or an agreement was reached on the multilateralization of the Chiang Mai Initiative in Bali. And the idea here is that previously the Chiang Mai Initiative was a set of bilateral swap agreements, right? So if a country undergoes an economic crisis, they can request from another country funds to pay back their lenders. And so there was a series of bilateral swaps, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Japan, etc. But the idea here is to pool all the funds into a single pool and create some rules so that countries can access money from that pool on a case-by-case basis. Implementation is planned by year end. The total fund will be $120 billion. That compares to the IMF pre-crisis was around $250 billion. Post-crisis, the IMF is targeted to reach $750 billion. So that gives you some sense of the magnitude of the initiative. Decision-making will be consensus on fundamental issues like reform of the voting structure and so forth, and majority vote on lending decisions. The structure will be as follows. So contributions are really dominated by China and Japan, as you might expect, because China and Japan are the two largest holders of foreign exchange reserves in the world. And there's a borrowing multiplier that will be applied so that the borrowing capacity of less developed states, primarily ASEAN, will be significantly higher. Voting power has not been quite settled down yet, but you know the most likely voting rule will be based on contribution percentage, right? If you do one country, one vote, it's going to be dominated by ASEAN, who are most likely to be the borrowers. And just like the IMF and the World Bank, the contributors tend to want to have more say over how their funds are used. So, you know, it's probably going to be closer to the contribution percentage, maybe some additional per member voting allocation, as is done in the IMF. But, you know, one problem with this is obviously, as you can see, the voting will be dominated by China and Japan, right? So it's very clearly going to be a China-Japan institution, 64% of the total votes. So will the CMIM or some similar organization be functional? There are very serious problems with this type of cooperation. Currently, only 20% of the borrowing through the CMIM is delinked from the IMF. In other words, the country can access those funds without having an IMF program in place. There's some discussion of delinking completely, but there's essentially a dilemma or a trilemma, I suppose. Essentially, so you think through what different possibilities are there. So what happens if you delink completely from the IMF, but without conditionality? So Japan and China would lend freely to Thailand, for example, with no conditions. This is a problem because even given criticism of the IMF in Asia and other countries, international creditors are very hesitant to lend with no conditions whatsoever. The idea here is that some reform is probably necessary, and you don't want to provide the funds with no strings attached at all under most conditions. There might be some situations based on pure short-term liquidity crisis where, you know, that might be helpful. So there are moral hazard concerns. And, you know, in the Asian financial crisis, Japan's argument in most cases was not no conditionality, but it was less stringent conditionality in Indonesia, for example. So what happens if you delink but with conditions? Well, this becomes very politically tricky. So can China and Japan, who clearly dominate the institution, impose painful economic conditions on, for example, Korea? Is that going to be politically acceptable? It's hard to see that, right? With the IMF, at least you have universalistic representation, so that people might blame the IMF, but it's less clear which country they can blame. Sometimes the U.S. is blamed for IMF policy. But with an Asian fund or a CMIM like this, it's very clear who's responsible, right? So there's a question of whether the institution offers enough political cover. But what if the IMF link is maintained? The funds may not be sufficient. All right, so if you look at 20% of the funds for Thailand, you're looking at $2 billion U.S. dollars versus the Thai bailout package during the Asian financial crisis was around $17 billion. So it's probably not enough funds to really move the needle in a significant way. And Korea's recent swap agreement with the United States during this crisis to some extent demonstrates that the Asian side of financial cooperation might not be as functional as we would like it to be, because Korea really went to the U.S. rather than utilizing the resources in Asia. So there are serious questions about whether or not this will work. However, there's still a lot of resentment against IMF intervention in Asia. So this raises a serious problem in the sense that the IMF may be resented, and therefore in a future crisis in Asia, the IMF might not get involved because the political stakes are just too high. But there might not be an alternative mechanism in East Asia that is really functional and that could really help. So my policy proposal is essentially, you know, perhaps over the short term, we should try to drive towards a compromise solution. And that would essentially mean some formal incorporation of the Asian initiatives, or the CMIM, into IMF decision-making rules, essentially on an ad hoc basis. So how could this be done? The fundamental problem with IMF governance reform is that European countries don't want to give up their voting share. And it's a prestige issue. It's about decision-making over the IMF in a broader sense. But on the Asian side, of course, there's the prestige issue as well, but the fundamental concern is about the IMF's policies towards Asia. So if the Asian countries, ASEAN plus three, Japan, China, Korea, et cetera, were to feel that they have a little bit more say over how the IMF is conducting its policies, some of this concern could be removed. So one can think of the CMIM serving in some type of committee role or agenda-setting role, where essentially lending decisions would have to go through ASEAN plus three before they're taken to the entire executive board. Or you might consider maybe selective voting power increases in cases having to do with lending to East Asia, where the CMI funding is added to member quotas in the IMF so that their voting power increases selectively for the issues that they're concerned about the most. And, you know, you might think about increasing the capabilities of the IMF office in the Asia Pacific so that some of the other concerns are dealt with, right? One of the other concerns is that the Bretton Woods institutions are dominated by personnel from essentially the United States and Europe and not enough representation from East Asia. So the reason I think this might be a good solution is it's functional. And it might be acceptable to all parties concerned. Essentially, it would work if a crisis happened in the near term in East Asia. It would give greater voice to Asian countries over IMF decision-making, and it might be acceptable to European countries that don't want to immediately give up their voting shares in the institution. And, of course, over the longer term, it would still be a good idea to continue to negotiate voting share reform so that the IMF becomes more representative of you know, the realities of the world economy. But this is going to take a long time. If you look at the history of negotiations over international organizations, you're talking about 20, 30 years, right? So realistically speaking, since that's going to take a long time, and the current situation in East Asia in regards to crisis response is not optimal, I think we need to start thinking about, well, what can we do over the short time horizon to make sure we don't have a big gap in the global financial architecture, but also work, of course, in the longer term towards a satisfactory solution. So that's it for me. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Philip. It was exactly what we hoped for, a good mix of accessible social science research methodology and practical and original policy recommendations. And I think you're probably right. The three dilemmas of the trilemma faced by the now soon-to-be possibly multilateralized Chiang Mai Initiative. The first one, a lack of conditionality creating a moral hazard. And the second one, too much conditionality causing blame on China and Japan or Korea. The obvious solution to the first two is the third one, which is keeping about 20% with the Chiang Mai Initiative and about 80% with the IMF. That seems like a pretty reasonable solution for the next decade or so. In fact, you may have seen we did a survey here of elites in nine Asian countries, and we asked about institutional architecture in a variety of contexts. One of them was financial crises, and the pretty strong answer in the region was, you know, rely more on the IMF, but buttress it with the Chiang Mai Initiative. So I think you're generally moving in a very reasonable direction for giving more capacity to manage global crises. In other words, more money from Japan, Korea, and China without changing the Europeans' concerns in the IMF. Let me ask you what's a little bit of a devil's advocate question. Your main explanation, there's a correlation, you showed it, between historical legacy, voting shares, and so forth. But my question is, how much of that is actually history and how much of it actually reflects the reality of global capital flows? Because Asia is regionalizing in trade with roughly 55% last year of trade intra-regional. But capital flows are still very global. And depending on how you measure it, it's roughly 80%. It's roughly, in other words, the capital flows, global capital flows, in some ways, if that's what you're looking at, are accurately reflected in the role of the IMF versus the role of the China Initiative, if you follow what I'm asking. So in some ways, the current financial architecture accurately reflects the importance of global financial flows, capital flows, versus regional capital flows. And perhaps if after this financial crisis, capital flows change and are more regionalized like trade, maybe then there will be more of a push. And so maybe that's the more important correlation, not history necessarily, but the nature of capital flows. So let me throw that at you first, and then we'll open it up, if that was clear. I'm
absolutely.
Security guy, not an economist.
No, thank you for the question and the comments. I think, you know, so I've looked at the negotiations over the voting shares, you know, fairly in depth. And, you know, that doesn't come up very often. I think, you know, the argument tends to be, well, you know, we've become a bigger economic player in the world, and therefore we should have a bigger share. And, you know, the opposite side doesn't tend to make arguments like, well, you know, our banks are more globalized and they tend to lend more, so we should have a bigger share. You know, capital flows are not formally part of the quota calculations. You know, you could argue that, you know, at least today, based on things like capital flows, it might be an accurate representation. You know, but if you went back to the 1980s when, you know, Japan was becoming, you know, in retrospect, this was sort of a facade, but Japan was becoming a major financial power, you did not observe an increase in Japan's shares immediately in IMF representation, for example. So, you know, I do think there's quite a bit of history involved. You know, if you were to adopt a realist sort of perspective and say, well, you know, the powerful countries control the IMF, you might have expected to see a little bit more influence of Japan in that particular period. You really didn't. In the World Bank, it was a slightly different story, which is interesting. Japan actually did make quite a bit of progress at the time. So I think that would be my explanation, is that there's quite a bit of historical legacy involved. You know, and capital flows, well, you know, it's true that, you know, global capital flows are increasingly becoming globalized as well, right? So, you know, I don't think the Eurocentric version of the IMF is really in sync with that version of economic reality as well, if you, and I mean, especially if you think about the next 5-10 years. So I don't know if that's
okay. No, it's good. Yeah. I think you're right, and I'm partly asking it for devil's advocate purposes, but with capital flows comes a certain leverage.
Yeah.
In international relations. Okay, floor is open. If you could identify yourself and then ask Philip your question. Floor is open. Just raise your hand. We have microphones. Well, maybe everybody is on vacation. Yeah.
Thank you for that question. You know, the presentation was already getting quite long, so out of necessity, I had to cut out quite a bit. I mean, the G20 is certainly an important element of this. I think the G7/G8 has exercised a certain degree of agenda-setting power over financial decision-making in the IMF historically. So the G20 could be placed in that type of role, it's still useful, I think, to move towards reform of the IMF on a formal basis. And, you know, this takes many forms, but I think, you know, the IMF you know, one element of this is being based in D.C., right? So there's an informal influence exerted by United States policymakers, ideology, et cetera. So, you know, one element of this might be really sort of the institutional dynamics, right? You know, and G20, I think, is one element of it, right? So at the top level, if you can get an agreement at the G20 level, move it into the institution, essentially, here's the agenda, why don't we think about this? That might be one way for Asia to exercise influence. But I think there are a lot of other issues that need to be considered as well. So, you know, certainly I think it's part of the solution, but I think it's not the only one.
Do you think it matters, Philip, that when the IMF was, when the whole Bretton Woods system was created, the countries with the largest voting shares were not only victors in World War II, they were also democracies with, you know, market-based economic systems. And do you think that the regime type and the nature of, for example, exchange rate convertibility and things like that should matter in this? In other words, China and its current configuration, does it make sense to have a more democratic international architecture and management of the IMF when you have one a country that doesn't have, you know, a convertible exchange rate and all the rest of the mm-hmm. things that the other IMF leading countries do have? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that problem over the 20 years will solve itself, of course?
No, I think that's a very good question. I think on economic issues, regime type matters a little bit less because interests are fundamentally aligned. With geopolitics, security issues, this is probably less so. But on most economic issues, I think you could find agreement regardless of regime type. There are some issues related to sovereignty, for example, right? Sort of delegating authority to international organizations in some ways that autocratic regimes might be uncomfortable with. But for the most part, with something like how do you manage international financial crises are bad for democracies and autocracies alike. So I think you can find a lot of scope for cooperation and agreement. And it would be very difficult, I think, to explicitly weight the degree to which a country is democratic or, you know, from a practical standpoint, whether their economy is market-based. Because, you know, when you talk about IMF reform, you're talking about things like GDP, amount of reserves, volatility of the current account. So if you start to include things like, you know, how democratic are you, or, you know, is your economy market-based, it gets very, very tricky, and there are not, you know, there's some measures out there, but there's a lot of subjectivity involved in actually constructing those measures. So it would be hard to implement.
How about for the G8?
Okay.
Which, until Russia was backsliding, was supposed to be democracies. Would you keep a separate architecture? I guess I'm asking a little bit broader question than the economic piece now, but would you clearly for reforming and in effect democratizing the IMF and the international financial architecture? G20 is a bit broader, obviously. The G7, 8, the OECD, democracy. So do you think that now needs to be preserved somewhere in the international institutional architecture? Sort of taking a little bit beyond the economic financial architecture represented by the IMF and Chiang Mai Initiative?
I think, you know, it could certainly be helpful. I think there are a certain set of issues that democratic states will find more common ground on, human rights, things like that. On economic issues, like I said earlier, it's not as obvious to me that regime-type separation would be helpful. You know, if you start excluding China or downplaying China's role in economic institutions because it doesn't have the right type of government or governance structure, I think you're really setting yourself up to quite a bit of dysfunction in the international economic system, precisely because despite China not being a democracy, it is still a very big economy and a very powerful player. So, you know, there are certainly some issues, I think, for which having a democratic group of states could be useful. But for the big issues of the day, financial crises, managing capital flows and so forth, I think you need to be as inclusive as possible.
I'm obviously showing my bias in the question. I agree with that. And certainly on the international financial architecture piece, the Bretton Woods system, it has to be inclusive of the major economic players. Yeah. The G7 process, the G8 process, when I was in the NSC, it was quite clear to me that the G7, the G8 set key themes for management of the international system beyond finance and economics that then permeated EU summits, APEC summits, and a lot of other multilateral discussions. And having that initial discussion among a core group of the major democracies mattered in terms of agenda setting. And so if you lose that by sort of letting the G7, G8 wither or even go away and replaced by the G20, you'd have to reproduce it somewhere. I think you lose something. But on the economic side, I think you're right. The Bretton Woods system was created when the big economies were also the democracies, and we now have this mismatch that we're going to have to cobble together a new architecture to account for the distributions in political power, economic power, and regime types.
But to push back a little bit on that point, I think the G7/G8 worked that way precisely because these were the most powerful countries as well as being democracies. And it's not clear to me that the same agenda-setting role can be played today, given that China is out there. You know, Russia, if you want to argue that Russia is less democratic today. With the exclusion of those countries, even if the G7, for example, sets the agenda, will that agenda have the same type of impact that it did back in the 80s, in the early 90s? That's not necessarily clear to me. So I do think it's helpful to have that, but I don't know if, you know, this is essentially a realist argument, right? That essentially the power has really shifted, so that on this informal capacity, it's not clear to me that it will be as effective as it used to be.
It won't. The difference between the G7/G8 in the 90s after Russia joined and the G5/6/7 in the Cold War was that the democracies in the G6/7 process during the Cold War were making the case for a certain form of political governance and values in the system that was contested. So if that is not contested, then you're in the best of all worlds where the architecture reflects the distribution of power and economic growth and so forth, their economic power and political power. But if you do have contestation over norms, then I would think there would be a natural impulse for the democracies to caucus or keep some core. I heard this in Europe recently at a large U.S.-EU summit about the rise of China and international architecture. And this case was being made most vociferously by representatives from Belgium and Luxembourg, who are arguing that values now suddenly have discovered that values matter because that's why they're in now. That's their rationale. But I think it goes well beyond that because the G7 G8 process was both sort of sending economic rules and agenda setting, but also political. Anyway, it's a good discussion. Yeah. We could it requires a subtle sort of mix of institutions and groupings, and the international system today is so power and values and so are so complex, the fabric of that is so complex, that there's not going to be one architecture. It's going to be a series of architectures, which is why I like your idea of sort of combining Chiang Mai Initiative with IMF for a period of time to deal with the requirements of the system without trying to create a single architecture, because it's going to be so hard given the different regime types. All right, we've gone back and forth. I want to open it up again. Tom?
Thank you, Mike. Tom, on the back of the Institute. The point you raise at the IMF, always been thinking about, there's always a discussion, who are going to be prepared for the size of the GDP, trade, those sort of broad economic measures, but always came back to the reason why Europeans want to keep the voting rights is because the European banks, for example, in smaller countries like Australia, they help to grow the emerging markets faster, like through small European banks and smaller countries. So I think I'd be aware that European countries, smaller countries, don't want to lose emerging share so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think even from the World Bank, I think it's still a dangerous organization rather than borrowers. So I think if some trouble in Asian countries or African countries again, what would be trouble is the banks, not really the countries or borrowers itself, but the banks, which lenders are in European countries or Japan or the US banks or German, French, UK banks. So we need to, I just want to point out that we need to be careful talking about representation of international organizations. It's part of the financial issues. It's not just a trade or GDP size. It's part of the who's a player, who's the international banks part of those discussions. Well, in your discussion, in your presentation, I think you have taken the objective view that it's been taken for a long time for change of the national language. So I think it's a need.
So that's the microeconomic version of the macroeconomic question I asked about capital flows. Tom, so you think that these Europeans actually have a legitimate case to continue voting share, not just reflected by GDP size? As an Asian banker, you feel sympathy.
Well, in the international world, what Eastern you say, it's always back to the U.S., Europe, and Japan for the national acting of the financial sector. So I would support the European targets. But I also support the Asian countries needs to help each other in coming years. Although at this moment, the Asian banks, China or ASEAN banks are quite small. They only deal with small domestic issues. But more and more, they lend each other between the Asian ASEAN countries. So I think that's a good important discussion.
Yeah. Thank you for those comments. It's very interesting. I certainly agree that we need to take into consideration the role of these countries like Switzerland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and so forth. I think if that's the argument, there's a way to essentially include that into the quota rules, right? If you want to make the argument that we have a lot of banks who do a lot of international lending, so we want to have more voice over IMF decision-making. There's an argument to be made about including some measure of cross-border lending in the determination of the formulas. But I don't think that's the argument that's made, right? I think that's the reason why some European countries might resist redistributing the formulas or the allocation of the votes. I don't think that comes up in the discussion very much. So in that sense, when I think about how you might efficiently run an IMF, sort of putting aside all the political considerations, my feeling is that, if you look at the countries that have the most economic exposure, whether it be bank lending or direct investment, and you let those countries have some greater voice over the decision-making, that might make the process a little bit more fair and efficient. The problem with the current system is, countries have different relations with different areas of the world. Japan, at the time of the Asian financial crisis, really had an oversized stake in the countries that were hit, and that's, I'm sure you're very familiar with. The problem was that Japan's perspectives were reflected very minimally in the IMF decision-making structure. And what I'm trying to get at, I think, with my idea on incorporating the regional and global level institutions is that perhaps there are times when it's better to delegate some of these decision-making capabilities to the actors that are really interested in resolving the problem. You know, because during the Asian financial crisis, the argument coming out of Europe to a significant degree was, well, moral hazard. You know, we have to punish these countries for taking on excessive risk. We have to punish the financial institutions. But, you know, for the most part, these were Asian countries, Asian financial institutions, Japanese institutions in particular. So if there is some mechanism by which you can elevate Japan's role in the decision-making in crises like that, then maybe things will be a little bit more balanced. But as the current structure is set up, the U.S. and Europe always have greater influence, which is probably not as helpful. So, but thank you for your comments. They're very useful.
Others? We've heard from the banking sector. Anybody here from the IMF? Are you, how, Japan wanted an increase in voting shares in the 70s and 80s. Does China really want, in the same way Japan did? This is not a rhetorical question, I don't know, but I have my suspicions. Does China really want that larger stake in the IMF?
That's my impression. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't talked to the highest level, obviously, Chinese yeah. government officials. You know, talking to people who are associated with the IMF and, you know, who are not necessarily at the high politics level, my impression is that, indeed, China prefers to have a larger share. I don't know, you know, what the policy priority is. Is it sort of down here? Is it up here? It's probably not as high up as Japan's initiatives were right. in the 80s, at least on an impressionistic basis. But, you know, in some sense, you could argue that, well, China's stake is still at a low enough level that, you know, maybe it's not worth that investment to go from, what is it, 3% to 4%. You know, maybe they should wait until it's looking more like 8% to really make that political maneuver. But, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. It's an interesting question.
There's an assumption that China, you know, the various Gs talked about with China, G2, for example, very unpopular in Europe, very unpopular in India, pretty unpopular in Japan, this G2 concept that the U.S. and China would form some new bipolar axis to manage, you know, mm-hmm. condominium to manage the international economy. But it's pretty unpopular in Beijing, too, with what you find, because they don't want the responsibility and the risk and the moral hazard and all the rest that comes with that kind of thing. And I remember in exploring with Beijing some changes in the G7, G8 process, and they were incapable of giving a response. The British, when they hosted the G8, wanted to reach out to China and begin exploratory discussions. They couldn't formulate a response. They couldn't decide as a government whether they really wanted to take on the prestige, sure, but the responsibility, the risk, given everything that they're trying to manage at home, there was no consensus they wanted it. But 3-4% is not so huge, so that sounds reasonable. Well, thank you, Philip. Very interesting. I learned a lot. We're going to Philip is going to produce a short platform, a short essay based on this talk, and we've also tried to put, if our website will allow it, Nick, to put the presentation up on the CSIS website, the Japan Chair link, because some of those charts were really quite interesting, and people may want to download them. So we'll look forward to seeing further iterations and publications and speeches. And it's been very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.